Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
We welcome you to our weekly program, We the People, the Constitution Matters, which airs each Friday at this time. This broadcast is also repeated during our weekend program schedule. Each week we have a distinguished panel of experts who are here to discuss our topic of the week. With a lifelong interest in history and economics, Phil Duffy has taught the Constitution to grassroots organizations, high school students, and at Widener University's Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Also joining us today, David Whitney, pastor and senior instructor at the Institute on the Constitution in Pasadena, Maryland. And our coordinator is Mr. Gary Porter, executive director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. How are you, Les?
Excellent.
Well, everybody's talking about it, so why don't we? And I'm referring to, of course, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that has found its way onto the headlines of every blog and every newspaper and every commentator site. So when I saw that Indiana had passed this law, I wrote my essay over the weekend on this topic. I had no idea of the breathtaking speed with which Indiana would buckle to the political pressure being brought by the homosexual lobby. But anyway, let's lay the groundwork here. Back in the early 90s, we had a case where the state of Oregon, I think it was, fired some people from their drug prevention program because they had used peyote. They were Native American Indians, and the backlash from that resulted in the National Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which Bill Clinton signed in 1993 to make sure that people had the right to exercise their religious beliefs without prejudice. And so this was, it was supported by groups on both the left and the right. The ACLU supported this. A conservative group like Traditional Values Coalition supported it, Christian Legal Society, etc. We had bipartisan support for this. And it was an attempt, of course, to broaden the understanding, at least, not necessarily the words, but the broaden the understanding of the First Amendment, which is to prohibit or enjoin Congress and now by use of the incorporation clause, the incorporation doctrine, other local and state governments as well, from abridging the free exercise of religion. So that First Amendment had become cloudy. Cloudy is a generous term, by the Supreme Court's decisions, and the RFRA then was an attempt to make sure that the First Amendment was not being incorporated or not being understood to abridge someone's right to exercise their religious beliefs. And in this case, smoking peyote in a Native American religious ceremony. So the RFRA existed for quite a while. It was used as the basis for the Burwell decision and the Conestoga Wagon decision, which corporations were being required by Health and Human Services to provide contraceptive coverage in their health plans. But all of a sudden now, when Indiana passes a slightly broader version of the RFA, then the left has decided that is their line in the sand, and they're not going to allow that. So The overnight appearance of protests in Indiana has caused Governor Pence to reconsider and to require that the law be reworded to bring it more in line with the federal law. So that's where we are today. And apparently it is okay to exclude someone from your business or to deny service to someone if they're not wearing a shirt or not wearing shoes. But if they want you to participate in their political agenda and participate in their political speech, well, then you don't have a choice. You have to service them. That's apparently what the left is causing us to accept. So that's where we are today, and it's not a very pretty sight.
Gary, what appears to be is that the battle is really between sexual perversion having freedom to do whatever it pleases, including force Christians not only to say, we'll service these, but we'll celebrate these, because the issues that currently have been in the news are what I can only call sodomite unmarriage ceremonies, where sodomites come into a business, such as they did in Oregon with a florist, and demand that the florist provide flowers for their sodomite unmarriage ceremony. And if they will not do that, then they're not only going to be penalized, their business is going to be destroyed. In the case out there in Oregon, it looks like the woman's savings, the woman's retirement, and her home are going to be taken from her simply for refusing to go against her Christian conscience and participate in a ceremony that she believes, biblically correct, she believes what the Bible says about that ceremony, that it is not what it claims to be, that it is an abomination. It is not a marriage at all. So that's happened in Oregon, and of course, bakers in Colorado, and photographers in New Mexico, and on the list goes of Christians who are being persecuted. So what it appears to be, and it's obviously these same perversions of sexual activity that are the issue there in Indiana, because the sodomites have pounded on the state of Indiana saying, we're going to hurt you economically if you don't change this, such that we can do in Indiana what has been done in Oregon and Colorado and all these other states, where any Christian business person has no freedom any longer to follow their conscience regarding these sodomite unmarriage situations. So it's sexual perversion versus religious freedom, and what it means is that sexual perversion trumps or is more important than religious freedom. So if the issue has anything to do, touches in any way, shape, or form with the issue of sexual perversion, you no longer have freedom. It's interesting right. That we're talking about this on the Good Friday, because really this is a form of persecution against Christians is essentially what it is.
Well, it is, and I think the longer-range goal of this whole movement is to do away with Christianity in the United States, or at least force it into perhaps underground status or closed-door status. They don't want any sign of Christianity being in the public square, and this is just one more step in that project. But the one of the most agonizing things about this is the door doesn't swing both ways on this. A Christian man went to 13 different gay bakeries and asked them to bake him a cake with the words "gay marriage is wrong" on it, and he got turned down. And yet nobody's saying anything about that, because that's apparently within their rights to refuse this sort of service. So it is the most hypocrisy, the greatest example of hypocrisy I've seen in a long, long time.
Well, we know that.
Slightly different approach on this. Let's go back over where we're at. As I understand, there are 21 states that have passed RFRA legislation. So we've got 29 more battlegrounds ahead of us, apparently. It seems to me we're building a skyscraper of legislation on shifting sands of judicial opinion. Now, if we go back to the basics, the Constitution rests on five governing themes: federalism, checks and balances, separation of powers, pluralism, and representation. And of these, I think separation of powers really is the issue here. The First Amendment's language and intent is absolutely clear. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Should be clear to everybody. You know, like, what don't you get?
Right.
The problem apparently goes back to at least 1947 in a Supreme Court decision, Everson versus the Board of Education, which drew on the founding father Thomas Jefferson's correspondence to call for a wall of separation between church and state, though the precise boundary of the separation remains in dispute. That seems to be where we're at right now. The problem is that Jefferson wasn't even at the Constitutional Convention. He was the U.S. minister to France and in no position to be involved in constitutional discussions. However, if you go back to, I think it was 1801, Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist repeats the exact wordings of the First Amendment. He then adds the wall of separation metaphorically, just as a kind of an explanation of what he has just said. It's not in contradiction to it. But you have to remember what Jefferson's role was at that point. Jefferson was the president. Presidents get to veto legislation, not create it. And in any case, they never get to modify the Constitution, which can only be modified according to Article 5 of the Constitution. So through Everson versus Board of Education, or the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, all three branches have managed to turn a government of limited enumerated powers into a playground for trial lawyers.
And it is indeed a playground, because it has certainly kept many lawyers in employment. Well, what about this situation where homosexuals who own bakeries are not being required to do the converse of what they're requiring of Christians? What do we do with that? I mean, should we just accept that, or does the Church of the United States have an action that they should be taking? And if so, what is it?
Well, in those 20 states where RFRA is law, those states ought to clearly enforce any situation where, like your illustration there, where you know, a Christian says, "I want this baker to bake something," and they refuse to do so. Well, what grounds are they refusing to do so is my question. The bigger problem, I think, is this, that religion to our founders, when they crafted the First Amendment, clearly referred to the Orthodox branches of Christianity. They were saying, this system of government is going to protect Christians in the free exercise of their religious beliefs based upon the Bible. It was not saying, and several of our founders made this comment outside of the text of the Constitution, but it was not saying that you're going to protect a follower of Muhammad when he believes jihad calls upon him to behead his neighbor, and we're not going to prosecute that as murder because he's exercising his freedom of religion. So we need to clearly understand, and actually state constitutions, I know Maryland and several other state constitutions clearly state this, regarding an expansion on the language of the First Amendment, that under the color of religion, someone cannot violate the laws of morality. And that raised the question, well, wait a minute, what do you mean by the laws of morality? Because most religions claim that they're establishing the laws of morality. Well, what they meant in those state constitutions is the laws of Christianity. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not kill. So obviously, murdering your neighbor, as the jihadist Mohammedan says, that is my duty, that is what Allah calls upon me to do, go behead anybody who's not a Muslim and who refuses to become a Muslim, go behead them. He claims that he's following his religion, quote-unquote, but the founders would say, wait a minute, you do not have the freedom because you are violating the laws of morality as defined by the Bible, which really calls back to the founder's view that William Blackstone clearly expressed, that there are three forms of law: the laws of nature, which are written on our conscience by the Creator; the laws of nature's God is the phrase that they used in the Declaration of Independence. Blackstone said that's the revealed law that is only given to us in Holy Scriptures in the Bible. And then there's human legislation, which Blackstone called municipal law, which he added is only valid if it complies with the first two, with the laws of nature and nature's God given to us in the Bible. So if we understand what they were saying about religion, we have to evaluate whether what the Sodomites are claiming, they would be claiming that, oh, it's my religion, sodomy is my religion, and therefore you cannot infringe upon my religion by forcing me to put something on a cake that I don't want to put on the cake according to my religion. Our founders say, sorry, sodomy is not a religion. It's a crime against nature, and it has no protection under our First Amendment as we crafted it in the federal Constitution and as similar statements were made in state constitutions.
Well, the you know, the biggest charge, though, is from the left, is that this is blatant discrimination, that the Indiana law, the way it was crafted, it doesn't require the state to be a party to the action, as other RFRAs in, say, Virginia or New Mexico do. But, you know, that's really not the case at all, because if I'm a businessman and I turn you away because you've come into my store without shoes or a shirt, I'm not discriminating against you as a person. I am discriminating against your activity, your actions, and that's exactly what is involved here. And so we got to get away, I think, from this idea that all discrimination is just perfectly, is totally unacceptable. Some discrimination is entirely warranted, and we condone it all the time. In the case of the no shoes, no shirts policy, we don't see that as discrimination, because we rightly perceive that it's not a discrimination against the person, against the individual, against who he is as a person. It is discrimination against his actions, and so when someone comes into a Christian run bakery and asks them to participate in the celebration of their wedding, that's an action. That's not, it doesn't in any way make a statement about them as a person. It is an action that the businessman is being forced to participate in that goes against his belief system. So this whole idea that it's discrimination, it really is a straw man that doesn't have any basis in fact. What do you say, Phil?
Well, I think we have to get back to basics again. Why do we need the federal government in all of this? Why can't two parties in a voluntary interchange, in a free market, determine what their action should be as long as each of those is acting morally? So
well,
why can't they proceed without government's involvement in all of this?
That's a good point, because we think of the right of contract as purely between two parties, that there shouldn't be any third party involved in the right of contract. Yet obviously in this case the government feels it has a right to step in and control that contract experience in some way.
Well, it's you might think of it as even a bigger category, because it's not just in this contractual arrangement, but the government puts its nose into almost every business contract as a third party, and that third party actually winds up controlling the contract in almost every business interaction in our entire country, which again is a complete rejection of our founders' view that that civil government has a very limited role in society. Family government has a more powerful role, and church government has a very powerful role, and obviously people need to be self-governed according to God's law. Civil government plays a small role, but civil government has, since our founders' era, increasingly stuck its nose into every business arrangement, every business contract, saying you've got to have a license for this, or else we won't permit you to engage in business. We're going to enter into the contract that you're going to make with your employees, and we're going to, you know, establish minimum wages. You've got to pay them this, and we're going to establish a whole long list of things. And so almost no interchanges take place without the government having its nose in that contractual arrangement. And that was really the opposite of our founders' view, because they almost viewed the right to form a contract independently between two parties as a sacred right. And
right.
The government would only be involved if they were breaking some clear law where the government had jurisdiction.
In Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1, the states are particularly prohibited from impairing any obligation or contract. So the states in the Constitution are specifically required to stay out of contracts. Now, that idea has been muddled by court cases over the years to where states are now allowed to impair the obligation of contracts under certain circumstances. But you know, there's another reference in the Constitution to the fact that the government is supposed to stay out of certain individual transactions.
And if the government were to step out and take its nose out of financial and business transactions, there would be a blossoming of freedom in America, and as well as economic prosperity, because all of those involvements that the federal government and state governments and even local governments get involved in business contracts means that the person who's doing business has to take that much more time and money and actually usually hiring employees to see that he's complying with all the requirements that the federal, state, and local governments place upon him. His profit margin goes way down severely. In fact, I had a friend who was visiting with someone from Russia, modern Russia, what's happened since the fall of communism there, and they were amazed. They said when they looked at the requirements to do business in America, they said there was more freedom in Russia to open and begin a business today than there is in these United States of America.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, you know, after the break, we probably ought to look at what should churches be doing, what should pastors and preachers be doing in response to the RFRA. Are we going to let the national media and the news media discuss this thing for us in their print and other media, or should we be having discussions in churches today as to how to respond to this? I think the latter, but I'd like to hear your views of that as well. What about this idea that Christians don't get the same sort of treatment when they require of gay bakeries, for instance, that they participate? What should we be doing in response to that?
Well, I know that from my pulpit, at least, there's very clear declaration of here's what God's law requires of us as Christians, to stand on the truth no matter what comes, including persecution, should that come. And also a clear message to the civil magistrate, as I testify at our state house frequently, testified one time this legislative session, that they are going to be held to God's standard. They've taken an oath before Almighty God, and we as Christians need to witness to those state legislators and federal legislators as well that there's a day when they're going to stand before their maker and give account for what they have done as a legislator, that they've sworn an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution, and if it's a state position, the state constitution, and that standard is going to be held against them on Judgment Day, and quite literally they'll be held to pay if they have violated that constitutional oath that they have made.
Well, yes, I wish all legislators would keep that in the back of their minds. Unfortunately, the way we see them acting, it's doubtful that they do. Well, Les, how much time do we have left?
We're about 30 seconds out. I think we're going to bring the music in shortly.
Well, you know, I think this whole issue needs to be given a lot more discussion than it so far has been. And I would contend that every church needs to have this on their agenda in the next few weeks.
You're listening to our program, We the People, the Constitution Matters. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge Peace and Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Welcome back to our program, We the People, the Constitution Matters. Our guest today, Mr. Phil Duffy, also Reverend David Whitney, and our moderator, Mr. Gary Porter. That was a good discussion so far. Let's pick it up, and where do you want to go now, Gary?
Well, David mentioned earlier, and Phil did briefly, about the concept of natural law. It's interesting. I'm having an online discussion, an email discussion with a friend in the local area, and he contends that all law is man-made. That is, all law is civil law. There is no law outside of whatever man creates. And, of course, that's not the view of the founders. It's not the view that underpinned our legal system until, well, nearly the turn of the 19th century. But it is definitely the way people view law. Many people view law today is that all law is man-made, but they don't seem to understand the implication of that. You know, if all law is man-made, then tomorrow's law is potentially completely different than today's law, because man has the ability and shows his tendency to flip-flop quite readily on issues. I was for the war before I was against it, or that sort of thing. So I'm trying to get through to my friend that he has protection in the idea of natural law, that the idea of an immutable law, a law that is fundamental and unchanging, protects everyone from the proclivities of human nature. And I'm not real sure I'm making any headway yet, but it's a case I think we need to be making all over, because America, as writ large, has abandoned the idea of natural law. What do you say, Phil?
Well, I'm teaching a course called Whatever Happened to Penny Candy, based upon Richard Mayberry's book, and he gets into this subject after going through multiple chapters on economics. And the basic point that he makes is that there are two systems of law. One, the civil law, the law that you mentioned, the law that is made by man. And then there's the common law, which is derived from the natural law. And one of the distinctions between the two systems of law is that the government is a party in all civil law, as opposed to common law, where the government intervention is only involved to the extent of the rule of law. In other words, a constitution, if you will, as the basis, and legislation consistent with that constitution, as long as the constitution is consistent with the natural law. And Mayberry concludes this thin gem, if you will, Whatever Happened to Penny Candy, with a list of all the nations in the world, those which have the most economic freedom and the best economic results. And you start off with nations that are basically common law based. And you get down to nations like Venezuela, North Korea, the Cameroons. They're all civil law based. And they're economic tragedies. They're also political tragedies. So I think the answer is we've got to move back to the common law idea, which in turn is based upon the natural law.
Well, that's great. David, what do you say?
Well, yeah, I was going to add to that, because, Phil, you're exactly right. But many people object to, and they don't necessarily use the terms we're using to, speak of these things, but they object to saying that the Bible, which is really the foundation of English common law and American common law, they object to the Bible being considered a legal system because they say, well, that's just like Sharia law, you know. The Mohammedans claim that their holy book is the source of law and that if they follow their holy book, there'll be liberty. And obviously, you know, you clearly look at those countries where Sharia law is imposed and there is no liberty. There's certainly no freedom. And your God-given rights are not protected in such a system of law. But they fail to understand what our founders clearly did understand. If you look at the world religions and contrast and compare them, it is true that in Mohammedanism there is no liberty and freedom. Anybody in Saudi Arabia recognizes that they don't have freedom. And it's also true in when a Hindu religion dominates a culture and its law system is imposed. There's no liberty for those who are non-Hindus to have right to private property, right to contracts and so on. All of those liberties are gone. There's only one religion in the world that secures the God-given rights of those who are not followers of that religion, who are in that society. And that is Christianity from the Bible, will protect the God-given right to life, to liberty, to property, and so on, of those who are not Christians within that society. Which is, if you could look at our founders, if they were making a decision based on simply what is the freest form of government that will secure the God-given rights of the people, that form of government is based upon Christianity, based upon the Bible as law, which is the foundation of the common law. Many people don't know that the common law really does draw its roots directly back to the Bible. If you study English history and you go back even beyond the Magna Carta and say, where did the ideas come from for that document? Well, they came from King Alfred, who established the common law. And where did King Alfred get his ideas? He got it from a book that was written by St. Patrick for the Irish. When Ireland was converted by St. Patrick in the 4th, 5th century there, he decided, because the people there were pagans, that they had no idea about right and wrong in terms of what would be a true just law system, he wrote a book of the law based upon the Ten Commandments and based upon the Bible to give the people of Ireland a law book that followed the Creator's design for law. That was adopted by England, became their law, and was the foundation of English common law and ultimately the foundation of American common law. So if we were to contrast, and really what we have is a religious war going on. The Sodomites have their own version of what they believe is right and wrong, and they're going to impose that. As Gary, your illustration is perfect there. They're going to impose that on everyone. It doesn't matter whether you believe what they believe or not. You're going to be forced to participate in their Sodomite unmarriage ceremony, but you're not going to have the freedom to force them to put a statement on a wedding cake or any kind of cake that they disagree with. So it's a one-way street. In other words, they're imposing their, what we would call their immoral religion, upon the rest of us, and therefore we do not have freedom. What we understand, what our founders understood, is true freedom only comes when the laws of nature and nature's God are followed in a society.
Where does someone go to understand common law better? Has either one of you gentlemen encountered any books that discuss common law and how it is formed and what it consists of?
Well, I understand that it comes out of Blackstone's commentaries, and there, one of the other guests can probably comment on that better.
Yeah, David, Blackstone's commentaries are, from what I've read thus far, kind of the best source. He was drawing together all that English history basically had produced, because England did not have, and does not have even to this day, an actual written constitution. But they have practices, they have precedents and so on that have worked out details about how that law is applied. I've read a couple interesting biographies, one of St. Patrick, and that was a fascinating biography because it did hark back to the fact that Patrick, when he converted Ireland, really established a legal system for them, and took them from a barbaric situation to a civilized situation, and that book he produced for them ultimately became what King Alfred in England adopted and saw, this is a wise set of laws that if we follow this, we will be preserving the God-given rights of the people. And so I guess you really have to ask people the question, where does law come from? And for this battle that we're seeing take place today, law comes from whatever the legislators in their mind come up with. And so if the legislators say, we're going to force all Christians to kowtow to whatever sodomites demand of them, because I'm sure it won't stop with wedding cakes and flowers and photography for weddings. That's just the, you know, the nose of the camel under the tent here. That's just the beginning. They ultimately want to force us, and they've expressed this agenda in the book After the Ball, which is kind of the sodomite manifesto of what they're going to do to America. And if you read it, you'll find, you know, they have achieved a great deal of what they set out in that manifesto After the Ball. But their aim is not to allow us to live side by side at peace. And their aim is to force us to celebrate their sodomy, force us to hand our children over to their sodomite indoctrination, and force us basically to become a non-Christian country. That's what they set out as their agenda. So, you know, people, you know, looking at just the little incidents along the way, they want to see the big picture. They ought to read what the sodomites themselves said in that book, After the Ball, that their aim was to de-Christianize our country, and therefore, as a Christian, you will not have the freedom, not only in your bakery business or your florist business, but you won't even have the freedom in your churches. That's their agenda as well, that yep. ultimately in your churches you will not be able to proclaim what Romans chapter 1 says about sodomy, or Leviticus chapter 18 or Leviticus chapter 20, what the Word of God from one end to the other says about the sin and the abomination of sodomy. You won't be able to say that either. In other words, you will have no religious freedom when they get finished with their agenda.
And, so what do the churches do? What do the pastors do? What should they be doing in the next few weeks? What would you do?
Well, clearly what needs to be presented is what God says about this particular sin. That many Christians are confused about it because they think, well, it would not be nice to these people if we talked about what the Bible says about this. But that clearly needs to be presented. First of all, their whole theory that they began with was an agenda to change our thinking by changing words and actually imposing words upon our culture. One of those words is the word homosexual, because that word itself presupposes that there are not just heterosexual people, but there's this other category of people, homosexuals. God's word denies that. God's word says no. At the beginning in Genesis 1, God created male and female. Yes, there are males who have perverted desires, and yes, there are females with perverted desires, but they are male and female. There is no third category of people, or as many of the sodomites tout, that there's 26 different varieties. You know, there's now you see gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender questioning, and on the list goes. They got 27 different categories of human beings. God's word says, no, there's only two, male and female. And Christians, in a sense, need to stop using their language, which is why I use the term, and many people are offended by it. The biblical term is sodomite. That is what God's word says. Here's a person who's become perverted in their thinking. So the first thing is we need to help educate Christians to have a biblical view about this particular sin. The second thing we need to do is we need to call upon those who are legislators in our local area. County is probably the first place and the most important place where you can make an impact. But then at the state level, federal government, we're going to have a difficult time changing Washington, D.C., but we can change what's happening locally. We need to see that they begin to set laws in place that protect our religious freedom. And we need to, I mean, the First Amendment does it, but obviously it's not functioning because of these reinterpretations and the rejection. And like you say, the turning of the phrases for RFRA, well, if the civil government's involved, then you may have some protection. But, well, if the civil government's not involved, forget it. You have no protection. We need to see that has changed, and that may just be on a local level, first of all, before a state law can be crafted to protect us.
Well, the actually the courts are pretty divided as to whether the national RFRA language can be used for individual defense or not. Some circuit courts have taken the position that it can, and some have taken the position that it can't be. So the courts are still not even sure about which way the national law should be interpreted. So it's probably disingenuous to make such a big deal about the Indiana law when the national law's language is even in contention. But here's another thing that Christians can be doing in addition to encouraging their pastors to speak out on this and holding discussions on this issue at their churches. Many people probably don't know that there's this pizzeria in Indiana which had the misfortune to speak out on this issue and is being put out of business. Their website's been defaced. They've received telephone death threats. And they're really not even sure it's safe to open their business anymore. But there has been a crowdfunding program put together, and people have donated to this business significant funds. Like I heard $250,000 so far. So there's a way that Christians can get involved and express their opinion by supporting organizations who have the guts to stand up and proclaim their rights.
Well, can I make a point about all of this? And earlier I mentioned the fact that somehow we have to find a way to get back to basics. We're talking about what actions pastors should take. It seems to me that there are three things that need to be done here. First, the pastors need to investigate and understand the Constitution. How many of them have taken a day-long course, in the Constitution? And that's what it takes. Basically, it's anywhere from 5 to 6, maybe 8 hours, maybe a little bit more. But anybody going through a thorough course can come out with an absolute understanding of the Constitution. That would be step one for the pastors. The second step, I believe, is for the pastors to identify any conflicts that they are seeing between the Constitution of the United States and morality. That is their role. They're teaching morality. They should be the ones to identify the conflicts and bring those to the attention of the members of their religious communities. And then the third thing they should be doing, it seems to me, is encouraging the members of their religious communities to learn the Constitution. Why not have Constitution classes right within the boundaries of the church walls?
Well, coincidentally, Phil, I'm glad you brought that up, because I know David has an opinion on this as well, but just like 3 weeks ago, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago now, I conducted a day-long seminar on the Constitution at a church, at the Taylor Road Baptist Church, just about 30 minutes from where I'm speaking. And, I've got courses available. David's Institute on the Constitution has courses available. And you're right, we need to be reaching out to the pastors and getting them involved, maybe even putting on a course strictly for pastors that can approach the document perhaps in a unique way that speaks to their needs. So I'm glad you brought that up. David, what would you say about that?
Thank you. Yes, indeed, what we are doing at Institute on the Constitution is providing materials that make it easy for a church to conduct a class on the U.S. Constitution based upon a biblical view of law and government as the foundation of studying the Declaration, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the subsequent amendments. And we have seen that most of our classes are done in churches all across the country. I've graduated more than 3,000 students in southwestern Ohio over the past, about seven, eight years now, most of those students have taken the class in a church in that part of Ohio where the churches there, unlike many churches here in Maryland, the churches there have no problem in conducting a class because they see this is part of what it means to make a disciple, and I think that's the key thing that needs to change in many pastors' thinking, many pastors at first would say, wait a minute, this is kind of political. We really shouldn't be involved in this. But I try to share with them, well, your goal as a church is to do what? Well, they'll always say, well, of course, to fulfill the Great Commission, which is to go make disciples. And then the next question then is, well, what does it take to make a disciple? And the answer is very clear. Jesus said, baptizing them and then teaching them to obey all that I have commanded. So the commands of Christ, 39 specific commands can be found in the Gospels. Certainly that's not the full list, but out of that, one of those commands is render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. So the question is, what does it mean to render unto Caesar? Well, people say, well, that just means pay your taxes. Well, not in America. It's far more than that, and you have to ask the question in America, what is Caesar? Is it that man that resides at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, or is it, you know, that group there in the congressional gatherings, or is it the Supreme Court? None of those is Caesar in America. Caesar is the Constitution itself. So how can a Christian obey Jesus' command to render unto Caesar if they don't know the Constitution? The answer is they cannot. So one element of making disciples is to teach them a biblical view of law and government and give them a working knowledge of the Declaration, Constitution, and Bill of Rights so they can fulfill their right, their duty as a Christian citizen, that is what knowing how to evaluate a candidate when they go to the ballot box, knowing how to serve as a juror, and by the way, that's the other course that we teach. The duty of the jury is defend the Constitution. We're actually going to be doing that course, and it's available a long distance if people want to do it by computer. So if they want to check that out, go to our website, theamericanview.com. But knowing what your role as a Christian citizen is, if we raised up Christian citizens to be in those positions, then we can have legislators who have a biblical worldview of law and government, judges that have a biblical worldview, and we could see a restoration of what our founders established rather than the continual destruction by those who reject the biblical view of law and government and reject what our founders crafted at protecting our God-given rights in our founding documents.
And David, I want to point out to our listeners just how easy it is to approach this project. This is how I got started, through the Institute on the Constitution's course. It is a completely lock and key, is I think the phrase I'm looking for.
Turnkey,
operation. You buy the host kit. Then you just put the DVDs in a DVD player and you let the course lectures teach themselves. So anybody, you don't have to be a constitutional scholar. You don't have to know anything about the Constitution yourself to conduct one of these courses in your church. You just need to know the very technical details of how to push the play button on your DVD. Now, once you've mastered that, then you can go ahead and teach the course. So it's really an easy way to approach this. And as you said, every pastor needs to understand this. Every pastor needs to be preaching the whole counsel of God, including what the concept of law is in God's eyes.
And by the way, I offer myself to anyone whose pastor has a question or, you know, has a struggle with this idea. Have them call me at Institute on the Constitution. You can go to our website, theamericanview.com, to get our contact information. But I love to talk to pastors about this because I think many pastors have been lied to in thinking, oh, you know, as Christians, we really shouldn't have it, and as pastors, we should have nothing to do with what happens politically. But what they don't realize is their freedom of religion, their freedom to actually preach the gospel is under attack, and that's what the Sodomite agenda, you can read their own words, what their goal is to shut down Christianity in America so that you will not even be able to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, his saving death on the cross, his burial, and his resurrection. You will not be able to proclaim that from your pulpit if they achieve their agenda. And by the way, they've achieved an enormous amount of what they set out as their agenda. They set that out back in the early 80s, and they've achieved enormously. And if they're not stopped, our freedom of religion in America will be gone.
Well, you know, if there is any good news on this Good Friday, it is that there are some things that can be done. There are some the agenda has not been completed yet, and so we still have some hope of turning this thing around. But it's going to take some action. It's going to take some some study. It's going to take some proactiveness on the part of the pastors, and that's what we need to get a point. And that's the point we need to get across to them, that all hope is not lost. There's still some things we can be doing.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for an enlightening discussion today. We're out of time. We would like to thank our guest, Reverend Mr. Phil Duffy, a local teacher of the Constitution, Reverend David Whitney, pastor and senior instructor at the Institute on the Constitution, and Mr. Gary Porter, executive director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia. Thank you for listening to We the People, the Constitution Matters. Tune in this weekend for rebroadcast of this program and join us again next week at the same time.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.